The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Phil Clement. Phil is the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for Aon, the leading global provider of risk management, insurance and reinsurance brokerage, human resource solutions, and outsourcing services. In his job, Phil is responsible for marketing strategy, branding, analysis, sales, and innovation. He is based in London, but he is a former Chicagoan, getting his MBA from the University of Chicago, serving on the board of directors of the Goodman Theater, and a proud, proud graduate of Neutcher High School on Chicago's North Shore. Phil, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Great, Kelly. Thank you.
Prior to doing research for this conversation, if you had asked me what your company, Aon, did, I would have said Aon is an insurance company. But that is apparently not the case.
Well, you wouldn't be alone.
No, that seems to be a theme.
Statistically speaking, the people that aren't familiar with us think that we're in the insurance industry or an insurance company. That's because we oftentimes deal with insurance.
Yeah.
So the two main things that we help people with is the companies that would be their risk. All the risks that they face.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, the answer to that problem is insurance. Sometimes it's not. It might be changing your strategy or changing the formulation of how your company works. And then everything to do with people. And
yeah.
Again, healthcare is one of the primary motivators there. And health insurance is a big issue. But that also goes to things like compensation and retirement planning, et cetera.
Yeah. I read in an article, and you just did it, but you simplified it once to say that Aon is about risk and people. And if I did the same for Second City,
yes,
I'd say we're about improv, comedy, and people.
I've always felt like the two had a lot in common from that perspective.
Yes, this might seem
odd. It always resonates with me when we talk about Second City and optimizing the risk-taking that people do in improvisation.
Yeah, the people part is so important because people don't act or behave in their own best interest. People are not inclined, nor are they trained in working well with other people. And people have all sorts of cognitive biases that affect the tension between perception and reality.
Ah, perfect.
Right? And
yeah,
that, and so
absolutely.
We are mining the same stuff.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's great.
It strikes me that marketers would be well suited to have some experience in psychology and behavioral science when you talk about this, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a couple of things that are very interesting about the marketing profession, and it's a real spectrum.
You know,
on one side, you have the ability to be a data scientist currently in marketing, and on the other side, you could be a complete you could focus really just on neurons and mem cells and how the brain takes in an image and remembers it and then uses it in decision making. In between there is all the things that we tend to think of when we think of marketing, which is, what does an advertising campaign look like, or how can we impact a sales cycle?
Mm-hmm. So you're playing with data, you're playing with stories.
Yes.
If you believe left brain, right brain, you're playing in both areas, right?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of you mentioned the University of Chicago. There's a program that I went to there as well called the University of Chicago Harris Graduate School of Public Policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very shocked one time when they picked 10 of the best B2B marketers in the country, and I was surprised and honored to be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there were two of my fellow graduates from the Harris School of Public Policy that were also honored.
Yeah.
And I think that was the notion of taking a look at social forces, being able to quantify them, being able to move them to some sort of decision making, and then be able to execute as you might on a policy issue.
I had a professor at Harris the other day. We have a mutual friend, and we've been having some discussions around around collaboration between behavioral science and the work we do in improvisation at Second City. So she hit me to this webinar, and it was about self-regulation.
Okay.
So, and this is all examining kids from early childhood to kindergarten.
Great.
Self-regulation is basically, you know, our ability to respond over experiences in a socially acceptable way, or not respond in a socially acceptable way.
Okay.
So they were playing games with the kids. So the kids who did head, shoulders, knees, and toes, because they're little kids,
yeah,
they would change the formula.
Okay.
And the kids who were very good at self-regulation had no problem pivoting. And the kids who were bad at it couldn't. And they got real frustrated, or they cried.
Yeah.
It got me thinking that we forget that we are lifelong learners, and the self-regulation thing takes place in the workplace. And I thought about people who cry at performance reviews. I thought about people who stand up to bullies or can find empathy with people who are struggling.
Sure.
And that there's a real self-regulation issue at play in work.
Oh yeah, completely. And I think this is actually has two dimensions in my life. One is that Anne actually does that type of work with cultures of large companies.
Wow.
And you know, some of the things that you mentioned are very individual traits, but they do roll up into what is oftentimes a corporate culture. And
yeah,
corporate culture has certain behavior that it endorses, and sometimes tries to get to move people in a direction other than what they would do naturally, right?
Yeah.
So there are places where it's perfectly acceptable to cry during a performance review. Like, hey, guys, this should be an emotional experience, right?
Right.
And go for it. And then there's other places where any sort of lack of composure in that situation would be completely inappropriate.
Yeah.
And those are big issues to navigate. Then you've got the same issues at our firm, right? So we've got 72,000 people full-time around the world in 120 countries that are all dealing with their own lives every day. And one of the big things that I've enjoyed as from a marketing perspective is trying to tap into the hearts and minds of those people, motivate them. And if you're a chief marketing officer at a firm, you have the opportunity to give the people that you work with something to believe in.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're creating the identity of the company.
Well, it's purpose.
Yeah, purpose, mission, et cetera. And that is really another one of the dimensions of the job that I love.
Yeah, and the thing that was striking me about the gameplay was, you know, just sort of letting my mind wander to the fact that, you know, as we are speaking, there are thousands of adults over on Wall Street right now, adults playing games.
Yes.
Which is about this stuff.
Right.
And they're reinforcing behaviors to make them better collaborators, better listeners. We see the power of the work in that, you know, the professional training part of our school is only like 150 people.
Okay.
So those thousands of others, I think we have something like close to 4,000 students right now. The rest are there for other reasons. And a lot of them are there because they're having trouble at home or at work.
Mm.
It's really interesting. All right, I want to talk to you about risk.
Okay, great.
In our line of work, we talk about the need to embrace risk, not recklessly, but with some rules of the road that can help you use risk without being decimated by it.
Yeah.
So two things come to mind: finding environments where you can risk, and in our case, that's like late night improv sets, and behaviors that support risk. Don't risk alone, risk fast, risk in context.
Yeah.
How does it apply to you and the way you guys play with risk?
Well, I think, first of all, the notion that taking on risk is not something you should fear is a big part of what we deal with in industry. So I think it's a common framework. And then, you know, on a global scale, humanity is just taking on a tremendous amount of risk every day, right? So things that there are classic risks like building your factory near an ocean, right? And
right,
it may fall over, it may get, you know, some of the kinds of weather risks that happen from earthquake, et cetera. And those are called traditional risks. Now, as humanity kind of pushes into different regions and we become more connected, there's things like pandemics, which were risks that we never really had to consciously address before.
Mm-hmm.
You've got cyber risk right now. I mean, it is a big thing that we're working on. I mean, it's a merger of behavioral economics. There's security issues that would normally be only in the terrorism world.
Right.
You're bringing together teams and groups to really figure out how these risks will play out. what people can do to address them, and in the worst case scenario, what do they need to have as a backstop?
Yeah, so you guys, you're living with the orientation that you've got to risk.
Yeah.
So we're going to help you manage that.
People are risking every day, and we've got to be their partner and support them in that.
There's a really cool T.S. Eliot quote I found, which was, "Only those who will risk going too far can possibly find out how far one can go."
I love it.
Isn't that cool?
I think that's a perfect quote for us to bring to our clients.
Yeah. Well, you can use it.
Thank you.
I'll ask for a royalty. I want to talk about Manchester United, man.
Okay.
Phil and I have known each other for years. We went to school together at Nutrier, and have maintained an unusual and vibrant relationship since. And I was over in London on Second City Business, and you kind of stand at the center of this sponsor relationship with Manchester United.
Yes.
I want you to tell the story you told me.
Which story? I mean, there's a lot of them.
I know there's a lot of them.
Manchester United, yeah.
So we were visiting. Phil was gracious and set up a chance for us to go to the London offices of Manchester United, and we were in this very cool boardroom. And we were asking him about, you know, what's involved when you have to broker these deals? You know, and I think for any of you who followed the Premiership, or even if you don't, you've probably seen the iconic Aeon brand. And recently we've seen the Chevrolet brand on there, and I think that's what prompted a bit of the question of like what goes on with that. And you had sort of an intriguing situation happen to you when you were talking about the deal making with regard to the sponsorship in Manchester United.
Yeah, so we worked on it twice, and I would say, you know, in each time, anytime you're working on something of that size and magnitude with a company, there's a team of people that you may be the one representing, but it's definitely a team of people. Large sponsorship deals are not something you want to do by yourself and without everybody involved, you know, law, executives, et cetera. But I think it was actually, to some degree, Kelly, it was a yes-and story. I mean, mm-hmm. Because when we were at the first round working with Manchester United, you know, there was a very traditional industry in sports sponsorship and a very traditional group of assets that went with writing the check, right? So you write a check, you get a certain number of assets, and you kill clean out a category for you, the sponsor. As we started to look at it, we knew that we probably wouldn't bid an amount that would clear out every category.
Yeah.
And so for the first time, we recommended a real partial set of assets that we thought would help us. Now, you mentioned earlier that you didn't know exactly what Aeon does, and that's because mm-hmm. we're B2B. I mean, people who are heads of HR, CFOs, work in risk management, they know who we are.
Mm-hmm.
What the Manchester United partnership was doing was helping them understand that we're big, we're global, we stand for excellence, which were things that we needed to work on, right?
Yeah.
in their consciousness. So I looked at the assets that we could accomplish that mission. Now, that was the first time, right?
Yeah.
And there were some a really good group of Aeon folks that were involved in that, and I played a part in that negotiation. The second time around, we went even further, which was basically we continued to be a sponsor that was of a significant note, but we took over the training complex, and we really took over the training complex. If you go to where Manchester United trains, it is all Aeon, and it is Aeon in a very sincere way, too. We work with their experts on things like health and nutrition and compensation and mental conditioning, things that are really quite substantial in that world. But that's because that's what we do as a business.
Right.
So we had hit diminishing marginal returns on the shirt sponsorship itself, right? Because that's really TV exposure.
Yeah.
And so I think the fun part of the story was just, you know, kind of the gameplay of who else is out there, what do they want, what would be best for Manchester United.
Yeah, who's bidding against you, right, for this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Who could construct another deal? And, you know, I think in the end, the first time around, we were not the highest bidder. The way that Manchester United was able to put together a series of sponsors ended up optimizing their revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are the kinds of things you don't talk to the other party about during a negotiation, but they are the kinds of things that you can basically see happening as a situation unfolds.
Yeah. So. And so you had another partner, there was someone bidding against you guys, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you had to outflank them?
Yeah, we totally did. We were, and that's very normal. It's a little bit dramatic. It could be, I mean, because you could get caught up in it. And
late night phone calls, weekend sweats.
Oh, it was a, I mean, at one point we were, I would say it was a straight 9 day.
Wow.
Where we only broke for about 6 hours a day.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So the thing that's also interesting about the sponsorship deal, that when I was digging around on the website, the stories, you guys mine stories from this partner of yours. And I love that you feature the receptionist at the training facility at Manchester United.
She's amazing.
Kath Pipps, is that her name?
Yeah,
and she's worked for the Reds for 45 years. So you're putting a face to an aspect of your business, right?
Yeah, and you know the thing about our sponsorship is we want the story to be the same as our company's story. Mm-hmm. And so we help Manchester United in the exact same way we would help a normal client. It's just a very memorable story when we do it. So one of the things that we would do is work with the head of HR on how do you retain your best employees, how do you train them, how do you give them longevity. Also, when it comes to someone who's been at your firm for 45 years, how do you prepare them in a very respectful way for retirement, both financially and mentally.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing attention to someone like Kath, our CEO actually gave her an award at the middle, during the halftime break at Old Trafford on one occasion. And it's something she will never forget. It had not had many opportunities to walk out on the pitch after working there for 45 years. And she's also the receptionist at the Ann Training Complex. So, of course, that's near and dear to our heart.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. This notion of stories. We could talk about what we do all day long.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not put in a memorable context, if it's not a story that people capture and will remember a year later, a lot of what the marketing profession does is just noise.
I have a friend who's a marketing guru of sorts, and I told her that I was going to be interviewing you. And so she propped up this question, which is, when I look at your bio and your areas of responsibility, it strikes me that any one of those areas that fall under your purview would be a full-time job.
Yeah.
And while I assume you have a lot of great staff that you work with, it strikes me as an extremely difficult to be a vision guy and an application guy when you are talking about customer programs, sales development, brand work internally and externally, digital strategy, not to mention thought leadership and justifying the ROI on all these massive budgets.
Yeah.
I mean, when do you sleep?
Oh, well, I sleep pretty regularly.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think, as you put it well, that there's a great team around.
Yeah.
And without that, none of it gets done.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I don't even just mean the team of hierarchy. I mean a team of colleagues. And we have to have a leader like our CEO, Greg Case, who has a very well-defined vision. And in the notion of improving, if you have a structure and a vision that you're going after, people can make their own decisions.
Right.
Some of that stuff can be self-moderated.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do it all. And in fact, you realize quite quickly that if you are doing it all, it's really a problem. It's not personally, if I'm doing it all, it's not going to be done well.
Right.
You learn that. And I think it's quite liberating over time.
Sure.
But it does mean that you have to invest in that team,
mm-hmm.
and you have to make sure that the rules of the team are working and that people understand what are the safe boundaries, et cetera, mm-hmm. for those pieces of judgment. And I think that variety of tasks in the chief marketing officer role is one that I've always found absolutely fascinating, right? And and I do love it. But that notion that anything gets done by a single person is
it's crazy, right?
A complete misnomer. And I would say when it comes to something like vision, I'm probably visionary once every 3 years.
Okay.
Because you have to spend a couple of years executing on things in an area. And everything has a bit of a calendar to it. Mm-hmm. And your team has to understand how that's rolling out.
Well, I think one of the things is, I imagine our brains are wired to think that it has to operate this way and not that it has to operate another way at the same time. When in fact, as you grow older, my experience has been, wow, everything's dual. This is like it's counterintuitive constantly, and it's zagging and it's zigging. So this idea of being able to play inside a dynamic, which total improv thing, is key. key to people when they're managing large enterprises, small ones too.
Yep.
But the really layered ones, like you're dealing, and you're dealing with some life and death stuff too.
Yeah,
with regard to, you know, no question. And I think the normal orientation would be like, well, you can't let them improvise. But the fact is, you can't plan for everything.
That's right.
It's surprise.
Absolutely.
So the one thing you can count on is that the unexpected will happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just last week with Brexit, we really. We had a very formal look at it. Every expert didn't think it was going to pass.
No, were you blindsided by that?
I was personally blindsided, but we were prepared for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had to prepare for that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I have two colleagues, one that works in kind of a specialist in external communications and one in internal communications. And they worked as hard as if it was likely.
Yeah.
To have that scenario ready. And God love them, we needed it.
And
our firm was out in front, and we're advising clients at a point where, you know, they were very, very nervous about what mm-hmm. their future might be. It's an incredibly important piece to deliver on.
You have a new PM today.
Yeah, I guess so.
And you have a new foreign secretary. Did you see that?
I mean, it's an unbelievable amount of change. It's such a strange place to live at this moment in time because London was so overwhelmingly in support of staying. To see the reaction of Brits who are very global. I mean, it is the world city, London.
Yeah.
And to suddenly feel like it has become isolationist is just not – doesn't work with their worldview.
Right.
And so it's very strange. And the weather's been terrible.
We
call it perfect English weather when it's overcast and rainy for weeks at a time. So it's just it's very sullen, very different than the August of 4 years ago when I moved there and it was hosting the Olympics and it was sunny and everyone felt like London was the center of the world. I mean,
right.
It really was. It was, you know, opening its arms to the entire world.
Wow. Can you talk to us about Aon's Pride Alliance? Because I thought that was awesome.
Sure. The Pride Alliance works on many different levels.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important one is that we believe that we want the most talented colleagues at our firm and want them highly engaged in their work. It's a religious doctrine for us, those two things. When you look at if you're lesbian, bi, gay, or transgender, you know, the workplace is oftentimes a very cruel and inhospitable place. And you can do things that are quite formal on
mm-hmm.
that,
mm-hmm.
That don't really tap into the heart and mind, that aren't really genuinely making a person feel like they can bring their whole self at work.
Yeah.
And what we're doing on the Pride Alliance is really trying to address that. Now, some of that self-organizing and just making sure that if you're in the LGBT community, that you have the same opportunities to mentor. You know, like in London where I work, the London insurance market has a long history of going to the pub after work.
Yep.
And you'll see a bunch of guys that are heterosexuals that are white going to the pub together. Now, a lot of mentorship happens in that. A lot of relationship, a lot of building trust happens on that. So you have to create other channels to allow people to have that same kind of opportunity, but they don't have to go and be part of the white heterosexual male community at a pub.
Yep.
We do a lot there. But I guess one of the cutting edge things that was really fun for me and very rewarding was getting sport teams involved. So at the world of sponsorship, I think you could say that sport teams oftentimes are a little bit behind. That industry's a little bit behind.
Sure.
And the reason is they don't invest a lot in their own corporate cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And in working with Manchester United, here's a group that invests a lot. I mean, they're probably one of the leading organizations outside of being a sport organization. They're just a great company. But you see how thin even they are.
Right.
And this is the best of the best. So dealing with things like diversity internally and then how that extends externally is not one of their specialties. So we got together a bunch of sponsors. Barclays was one of the first ones in. Aviva, which is basically the Allstate of the UK. Accenture, EY, great companies that are involved in LGBT but also do sports sponsorship and said, hey, look, we don't think corporate America is great at this or even global corporates are great at this, but we really need the teams that we sponsor to be at least as good as we are and to have the same principles, which means really working hard to cut down any sort of attacking language on the field.
Yeah, sure.
And also in the employment world.
Yeah. It's interesting. The diversity inclusion thing is it's a tricky area. And we're two white guys talking to each other.
Yeah.
So I recognize that. But as a colleague chastised me recently saying, yeah, and you need to be talking about it. Which I appreciated. I was in conversation with another professor friend of mine at the University of Chicago around this issue, and she suggested something kind of interesting. She said that we might be framing our diversity and inclusion efforts incorrectly, that she's less interested that someone says something offensive and more interested how someone reacts after they learn they
Agreed.
Offended someone,
okay.
That we need to shift from event blame to event response.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Right? Because the offensive thing is going to be said.
Yeah.
And a new thing will be invented for us to be offended by.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that just as we're talking about risk, that you rather want to focus less on trying to make sure there is no risk, because that's impossible.
Yeah.
There will be offensive behaviors. But can we educate people to pivot and learn so they don't do it again?
Yeah.
And they maybe learn something from it.
I think it's a great way to look at it. One of the things, kind of a philosophy that you have in the LGBT movement is the straight ally.
And I
love that notion, because the discipline around being a straight ally is simply, it is not up to the LGBT community to figure out how they can be comfortable at work. It is actually everyone in the community's role, and the folks that can have the biggest lead on that is the straight ally.
Yeah. Right?
And so we take that on as a full-time job to make sure that they don't have to. Right. And I think that notion of creating a world where you realize that it's incredibly diverse, that people are approaching every situation with incredible differences in perspective and background and different brains. And, you know, this goes back to marketing, too. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same notion. And then how do we bring them together in a way that there can be a common environment that feels very inclusive?
Yeah, you had a great quote I read where in an interview you said, aspire to give credit, not take it, which is a improv thing. Make your partner look good. Trust the process.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love whenever I have contact with improv for that reason, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you're just so reliant on others. You're using all of your abilities to the best of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always fun. It's totally engaging.
It doesn't deny the muck.
It doesn't deny the muck, no.
At all.
It glorifies it.
It glorifies it. That's where the comedy comes from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's so needed.
Yeah, absolutely. We're coming to the end.
Okay.
So I ask all our guests on Getting to Yes And to supply us with some sort of Yes And story, a moment in their life or work where they might have said no normally and they said yes and, or the opposite. Do you have one of those stories for us?
You had asked about Manchester United earlier.
Yeah.
I think when that first came up, I was sitting in an office in Chicago in the insurance industry, and I thought the likelihood of us doing the Manchester United deal was zero.
Did you know anything about soccer then?
No, nothing. Nothing. And in fact, when we signed the deal, I think it's safe to say that I still didn't know anything about it other than the math. It was completely mathematical calculation, no emotion involved. And I learned how emotive it could be. But, you know, when we got to the final calculations, it was things like, all right, we're in 120 countries. We'd have to hire 5 people to do marketing in 120 countries. I might be able to put together $1 to $5 million advertising budgets, which will be a rounding error, right? I mean, if you go into Denmark and you try to spend $5 million in advertising, you're not going to have a big impact on your brand.
Mm-hmm.
Comparatively, again, on the scale of 120 countries, Manchester United was a deal.
Yeah.
But
simply by showing up. On their jersey or...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we went from complete obscurity to, more people on the planet recognize our logo now than don't.
Were you number 2 before this?
What do you mean?
In the category, in your category, were you the...
Oh, no, we were before I joined.
Right.
And
you joined and they became number 1.
I think,
some other stuff might have happened.
Yeah.
We obviously had this
great founder, Pat Ryan, who put together through acquisition a great company. And then Greg Case, managed to take that and really, optimize that footprint and grow organically to the point that we became number one.
Didn't W. Clement Stone start the whole thing?
Oh, my God, yes. So he didn't start the whole company, but because there's parts of the company that are 425 years old.
Right? Wow.
Actually, there's parts of the companies that are 427 years old, as the Dutch will always tell us, because they were opened 2 years before the English opened up in the coffee houses of London. And it's an industry that a lot of companies have merged and acquired, et cetera. So Clement Stone at one point had his door-to-door insurance company, and he preached positive mental attitude and lived here locally, obviously, and was quite a character. That was a real cash business.
Mm-hmm.
And that cash business was part of the portfolio, and it allowed them to acquire all the professional services businesses.
Right.
And so then actually one of the things that we did early in our mix was sell that original insurance business. And as a result, we have no underwriting. We don't underwrite risk at all as a firm.
Did you, when you were a kid, did you ever go by that house and look for a glimpse of him in Winnetka?
Absolutely.
Yes, this is a share. We're the same age, and that is a thing that everyone would do because he was alive when we were kids.
And you and I had a mutual friend that spent a year in the coach house.
I did not know this.
Yes.
Lived in the coach house
when he was
alive?
Yeah.
With that weird little mustache?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I wish I could have lived in that
coach house.
Wouldn't
it have been awesome?
Yeah, beautiful estate.
I'm amazed at the legacy of that man.
Yeah, right.
Because to us here locally, oftentimes we can say things about him tongue-in-cheek because he was eccentric and quite a presence. But you'll meet a person that is 22 years old and trying to get out of a bad economic situation in Greece, and they're starting to work, and they are all about positive mental attitude and PMA and his methodology.
That's great.
Yeah.
Phil Clement, thank you for coming on the show.
Kelly, thank you for having me. Great to have a conversation, always.
You can learn more about all the services Phil's company has to offer at Aon.com. We'll see you next week on Getting to Yes And.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine going down.